Hi, welcome to Art Persists. My name is Faz, and today I'm very happy because, you know, I have somebody that...
I have this guy off the street.
I just wish we could just go for it, you know what I mean? Anyway.
We can always record it.
Yeah, we can. You can just jump into the first question.
Should we just do that?
Put the pressure on me.
Intro.
Right. Okay. throw it on me. It's fine.
Basil, welcome to Art Persists.
Thank you for having me.
No, obviously, like, thank you for coming. I was thinking, let's start hot. So
okay.
I'm going to say that you are a very successful filmmaker. You're really good. And you're Arab.
Okay.
And I want you to tell me what are the issues in the film industry and how do you work around that? So starting hot.
Okay. All right. Let's get right into it. So I guess there are two worlds that I'm now straddling. One is, you know, making films in the Arab world, which I have done. And more recently, I moved to the UK. So I've been here for a little over 4 years and have been navigating that world or making films in the UK. What's the most difficult part, I think, for me, being honest and transparent, is the writing. Mm. It takes a lot out of me. I like to immerse myself in a world, and what I've realized over the years is that's what I'd like a film to do. So when I'm watching something, I want it to be transportive, and in return, I want my films to have that effect as well. And I found in the research process, I get something similar out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I get to transport myself into a world that I might not be as familiar with. But it's speaking of it being a pain point, it's something I love, but it's also something that really consumes me or whoever I'm working with alongside. And then taking, you know, the amalgam of research that research, it's a funny way to describe it because it's world immersion, really, and it can have elements of sort of technical research, if you will. But then taking all of that and placing it into story and forming it into story and massaging it into something that's structurally sound with, you know, characters that are layered and stand up on the screen or on the page first and foremost, it's a long, grueling process. And for many, it's a lonely process. I've since started working with, try as much as I can to work with people.
Mm.
But I find research to be something that really takes a lot out of me. And again, once it's formed into a story, polishing and repolishing and repolishing, then trying to get it as perfect as one can, you know, and with whatever talent I have, is it's a long, tough process. But there are moments, especially, you know, once something starts to come to life, that bring real joy, and you know that's why we do it. Especially when that is then able to become a film.
Mm. And when you write, who do you write for? Are you writing for the production? Are you writing for the audience first, and then you make it appealing for production? How does that go?
It's a good question. I think the only person I can write for is myself.
Mm.
That's the only audience that I actually truly know. And I think that's true of many writers. I just have to assume that there are enough people with similar sentiment to me out there to believe that there's an audience for this film. Mm. There are some, you know, slight decisions here and there where, you know, you're like, oh, okay, this would make it a little more appealing to audiences, etc. But first and foremost, I'm writing this for me. And it could be different versions of me. So, for example, The Alleys, I wrote for sort of my 18-year-old self. And that's who I was, you know, checking against when I was writing. what would my 18-year-old self think of this, given, you know, whatever.
So even when it's the target audience is like maybe younger, you're going to the younger version of yourself.
I can't, because I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I really don't. I mean, especially if you tell me, write something for, I know, 14-year-olds, young adults who are doing, I have no idea how to even, how would one even start to think about what other audiences like or people think, etc. The best I can do is write for myself and hope that there's somebody who appreciates what I appreciate.
And if you like it, then hopefully somebody else will like it. Yeah, I think the same. When I make something, I feel like, I would watch that. Then that's it. That's my kind of...
It's the only honest thing that you can check against. Otherwise, you know, you can send it to...
But you have to be very honest with yourself.
Or you're going to send it to your mom and she's going to be like, bravo, I love this. This is the best thing I've ever read.
This is the best.
Which she does, and I love
you
her.
You look so
it.
Pretty. Okay, amazing. I think let's go then. I want to ask you about your early life.
Sure.
You grew up in Amman?
I grew up in Amman. It's a quiet... it's a quiet place, really, for the most part, especially in that.
It is. When I went there, I was like, this is Cairo, but much, much quieter.
Much quieter. Yeah. Much quieter. As for a second there, I was like, you're comparing it to Cairo. That's something.
It's a calm version of Cairo.
It's a calm version of Cairo.
Yeah.
It's a sedated version of Cairo. No, it's an interesting place. I grew up, I mean, I graduated from high school in 2004.
Hmm.
So late 90s, early 2000s, that's my... Yeah. My formative years, if you will.
It's the best period.
Yeah. It was it was phones, didn't have screens yet. So it was a lot of just going around the city and I don't know, pool halls and I don't know, discovering cigarettes and trying to hide the trying to mask the smell with perfume from our parents, you know, that type of thing.
And films.
Films is interesting because that era was also, you know, American influence in the region was probably at its, you know, not peak, I would say, but cultural influence, I'll say, in the sense that, you know, we had just got McDonald's in Jordan. We, you know, Disney Channel arrived in the region.
Was McDonald's seen to be like a prestigious restaurant?
Oh, I went and during one of the opening days, I was taken as a, you know, this is a favor for you. And we waited 3 hours for something that I was like, what is this? It was bizarre to me. But it was exciting. It was like, McDonald's is opening here.
Yeah, yeah.
But as far as films...
We don't like McDonald's here.
Yeah, no, no comment. I don't know what the politics are here, so I'll just leave it at no comment.
Okay, yeah, films.
Films, getting to films. So the first films I consumed were on, we had a TV channel called America Plus that was, you know, in the Arab world. Disney Channel, as I mentioned. NBC2, I think, was the one that played English language films.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of consuming American, like, blockbuster...
Yeah, yeah.
Type material that was, you know, now we know looking back that it had some sort of cultural
influence.
Yeah, not of the positive kind, but you know, maybe, I don't know. It is what it is. And so I ended up consuming a lot of these popcorn films. And what I loved about it is it took me out of quiet Amman into these worlds that were, again, you know, transported me somewhere else.
Yeah.
Whether it was, I don't know, Jurassic Park. Space Jam was something I loved as a kid.
Yeah, I loved Space Jam too.
Right? Yeah, underappreciated.
it's such a great film.
It's a great film.
Yeah, yeah.
I you know, couldn't tell you.
What's the name? Bugs Bunny and Lulu Rabbit?
I
love Looney Tunes. Yeah.
Looney Tunes and Michael Jordan is like that.
So good.
Whoever thought of that? I mean, I don't know if that'll fly now, but you know, maybe in another version.
They did a new one.
Did
it
they?
It wasn't as good.
I haven't even heard of it.
It's not good.
Okay.
With LeBron James, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not the intended audience anymore.
So, what was the film that like you watched and you were like, you know, I wanna make that. I wanna. Make films. When was that moment?
I'm a bit of a cliche with these films because of what arrived in Jordan. I was actually, I'll tell you, in eighth grade, ninth grade, whatever it was, at the local VHS rental
club,
yeah, whatever it was. I was like in the top 10 top 10 renters,
yeah
like trying to and they had a lot of these. Whenever a new American film came out, it'd be filmed in the theater. You'd see people standing up, but sometimes you just couldn't wait for the real, you know, for the original copy to arrive. You just needed to watch a film.
Yeah.
But early influence.
I am fully with you. We had a very similar upbringing. Yeah.
It's the only way to watch these things.
Mm.
Where else are we going to watch them?
Yeah.
So I wasn't a big like, oh, we used to go to the cinema and escape. No, this was my access, was these these.
You were not like a hardcore cinephile since age five.
Definitely not. Definitely not. I mean, I tell you what pushed the boundaries for me. Again, they're a bit generic, but you know, I'd say Requiem for a Dream, Fight Club. Mm. I don't even remember it now, but probably something like Memento.
Mm.
These are the films that sort of started to tell me, okay, there's an interesting way to tell story visually that's unconventional, that doesn't necessarily follow the classic story structure that I've been watching on America Plus in my youth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and the transportive element, leaving Amman by watching these. And obviously, going back to the Disney Plus, obviously, it gave me a distorted version of what the West is. You know, we thought I left Amman, or you know, in my youth, I thought the West is, you know, this is a post-racism world. This is a very you know, everybody's equal. We, you know, the world is in an okay place.
Yeah.
Little did I know.
Yeah. And. So when did you leave?
So I left. I left for university. I actually studied industrial engineering for a couple of years, like a good Arab boy.
Yeah.
Then
I studied finance.
You did.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing so great.
Oh, thank you. It's crazy.
Then I took a year off. Actually, I took a year off, and there were a few films. Shooting in Jordan. Jordan had just become a hub for international productions. It was doubling as a location for, you know, war films set in Iraq or Afghanistan. Mm. It also doubled for Mars eventually, and you know, Transformers shot there. So there are all these films coming to use Jordan.
Yeah, people don't know, but like most of Mars films are either filmed in Jordan or in Egypt or in Morocco.
And exactly. We're space to every. We're aliens, literally, on a number
it's
of
like
levels.
Like that kind of orange desert.
So I got to crew up on a couple of these. The Jordanian one I worked on was called Captain Abu Ra'id by Amin Matalqa. And it got me to see, and then I worked on The Hurt Locker. Mixed feelings about that. We'll set that aside. But it got me to see what a film set looked like when there were 50, 100 people on the same mission, looking to achieve a particular piece of art, or a, you know, and I was doing the everything from like lockups, which is you go, you ask people, please, we're rolling, can you wait over here for 5 minutes or 2 minutes or 1 minute or however long the take was, while we shoot, to, you know, I don't know, on The Hurt Locker they sent me in a car to go in the deep background so that I kick up some dust in so it looks like a little more dusty.
Yeah.
So it made me understand what it took to make a film and how many moving parts there are and how they need to move in tandem to just get a splice of the film, and I fell in love with that process.
Mm. And then you, what, did you get a scholarship or what, how did you?
I applied to USC and I eventually got there. I went to Santa Monica College for a semester and then went to University of Southern California to study cinema.
Mm.
So 2.5 years there, I made, you know, my cinematographer, Justin Hamilton, who's a close friend, he was a classmate of mine. So it was a great experience and really, again, starting to make my own films, our own films, and understanding that, understanding actually every step of the process. What I really enjoyed about that is, you know, you did the writing, the wardrobe, production design, the lighting, as terrible as it was, shooting, acting in friends' films, and then editing it yourself, and then sound designing it yourself, and then doing all of that. And that really having a hand in every part of the process was special to me, because now, you know, when I'm having conversations with whatever head of department I will be talking to, I you know, I obviously don't know the more complex things, but I can have a basic conversation with them on a technical level, so that we can, you know, collectively achieve. Or when they're telling me something or trying to explain something to me technically or artistically, I have some understanding of how it works.
Yeah. And then you went from there to being nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, just like that. I'll tell you, it was bizarre. I mean, speaking of the nomination, I remember putting in the application.
So,
okay, we'll go back to that. Yes.
Which is your film. It's the film that you wrote and produced. Is nominated for an Oscar and also a BAFTA winner, isn't it?
It is. Mm. It won Best British Newcomer for Naji Abnuar and Rupert Lloyd. Naji is the writer-director.
Mm.
Rupert is a producer, and I produced with Rupert and wrote with Naji.
Tell us about it.
So it is a story that follows a young Bedouin boy in 1916. At that time, let's call it Arabia, because there were no borders.
Mm.
And when a British officer on a specific mission arrives, the young boy follows him because his brother is an expert guide. So follows his brother and this British officer in secret, and ends up being swept up into this adventure and journey. And that's the basic premise of it. Since we were speaking of research earlier, Naji and I had written a couple of drafts in Amman.
Mm.
Structurally sound, but really it didn't have the pulse and the details and the cultural specificities that we needed to get that film done right.
Because you're portraying also like Bedouins, which is a minority group, and it's also in a specific time, specific era that... how did you get around that, the cultural specificities to make it true?
Well, after writing these two drafts, we read them and we're like, there's something just totally missing here.
Mm.
And Naji, to his credit, said, let's move down to Wadi Rum and live among the Bedouin. Pardon me. And so we did. We moved down. We got a small shack, probably the size of this room, and just lived. Yeah, and just lived there for a year.
Mm.
It was probably one of the most rewarding experiences of my life.
It's a completely different culture.
Totally different. You know, I grew up in a city.
Mm.
And so they don't live nomadically, but the essence of the nomadic life is still there.
Mm.
And we spent a year developing the script alongside them, doing acting workshops with them.
Mm.
To get all of the as much authenticity as we could, because we knew that Thieb as a film would live or die on the authenticity.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the main things that sort of gives the film a unique some of its uniqueness.
It's a great film in general.
Thank you.
It's a very, very enjoyable story. It's like, beautifully made. But you're right, the authenticity makes it very, very fresh. You've never seen something like it, kind of thing.
Appreciate it. I think for us, one thing that was important or a driver or something that we just kept in mind as we were developing it and creating it is we knew that the first screening we wanted to do was in that community, in Shakriye, which is a town in Wadi Rum. And we knew it needed to land there properly, mm. first and foremost. And then, you know, the film can travel wherever it wants. But it needed to ring true there, because we spent a year with people who we consider co-authors on this in a number of ways. And just to tell you how intimate this group was, I mean, Jasser, who plays Thieb, was our neighbor.
Was your neighbor when you moved there?
When we moved there. No, no, I'm not. No. Hussein, who plays his brother, is his cousin.
He's a little kid as well.
He's a kid. He's married now, actually.
Oh,
and
really?
Probably expecting kids soon.
But went to his during wedding. The film, he was what?
He was 10, 11?
10.
Mm. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. I mean, might give away my age.
No,
this was 2012. No, I don't. But this was 2012. So Jasser would be now 11. He'd be 24.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so, how is it like working with people that like, that did not act before, and how do you get them to be so like real and true and amazing actors?
Yeah, so we work with someone to develop a curriculum. They also came out and did a kickoff session and then a session right before we started filming. But for the majority of the acting workshops, about 8 months, once a week, Naji and I would do these acting workshops. Again, being non-actors ourselves, but we
were... So we're leading it yourself.
Leading it ourselves. And it was at first, it was acting games just to get people to loosen up and see how free they can get and then how in the moment they can be. That quickly evolved, not so quickly, evolved into improv scenes.
Mm.
So we started to create a lot of improv scenes where two characters would want something from one another in some way, shape, or form.
Mm.
And that became first so much fun, but also it became a bit of a gold mine for moments here and there.
Mm.
And then the last stretch was scenes from the film. And throughout this whole process, none of the actors knew what the roles were, nor did they know what the story was.
Mm.
And
wait, till it's being filmed?
To about a week or two before.
Oh.
Well, Jasser, who plays Deeb, I think we told him about a month before.
Mm.
Because he thought he was, because he was the only kid in the acting workshop. He thought I'm just having fun with these, you know, old folks.
Yeah, he thought you're not gonna hire him.
He thought I'm gonna be the kid in the film, and then he's like,
he thought just letting him play.
I'm the lead. All right, and then he really flexed his. He was 11, mm. but he was,
He does he realize the weight of it now, like.
Yeah, he does.
He knows that it's like...
I think he does.
How big it got.
It is. Me and him are still close
mm.
And have been throughout this whole time. And
yeah.
It's been something to watch him, you know, mature. But he's aware. But I will tell you that most of us are first-timers, by the way. So they're first-time actors, but Naji's a first-time director. Rupert and I are first-time producers. A lot of the crew are first-timers. So we didn't expect any of what came when the film came out.
Mm.
None of it. So
amazing story.
Yeah. So at the time we just tried to, you know, about a year in the desert, 5 weeks, 6 weeks of shooting. But really, you know, setting it all up, up to that point, we didn't anticipate any of this.
Mm.
Yeah,
but you are a good actor because I saw you in I saw you in that scene in the alleys.
I was actually in Thebe as well, by the way.
Were you in Thebe?
I am. I get shot three times in different outfits, so I perfected the the stunt.
Yeah. Oh, you were like from up the mountain.
I get shot at from up the mountain. So
and it was you.
I'm the guy.
Different place.
Yeah. So. Yeah,
I see.
I don't see a future for myself, no.
So those are the cameos for people that are confused. and then what after the was how did you go from there to a film that was for some reason called the most what? Controversial was like the most controversial film in the Arab world.
Right, a bit of an exaggeration. But
it's such an exaggeration, and I just want to say that I was on the edge of my seat.
Okay.
For the whole duration of this film.
Amazing.
And it is incredible. That's the alleys.
Thank you.
And I am from Old Cairo,
mm-hmm.
So I'm from Bab al-Sharia. So
okay.
It's very very similar.
Okay.
Similar characters, similar everything, and. And I have no idea how you managed to make this amazing drama out of it and how you made it look so realistic as well. And it's just incredible. I think that film is one of the best films I've seen. Like in a long, long time.
Right.
Yeah, if not ever.
Oof.
Honestly,
oof.
Yeah, I think it's such a great film.
So I we'll put that on the poster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just
I think
write
the
my
best
name.
Film ever. Faz. You'll know, and you from wrote and food I can't eat.
It's good food I can't breathe.
Yeah. No, I shouldn't eat, maybe. Okay. So how did we get there?
So you wrote and directed.
I wrote Allies. And directed The Allies. So I think subconsciously I was trying to do something that was the antithesis of Veeb. This is a multi-character film. It's an urban film. It's pulpy. It's again appealing to my 18-year-old self. It's this pulpy thriller.
Mm.
And how it came about, I think there are two big factors in how I approached the film, and they came at different times. The first was you'd hear stories in Amman, in the streets, of different, gossip is a big one. Yeah, you'd hear different gossip in the streets of Amman, and I wanted to encapsulate that in a film somehow, and so
basically, I just want to maybe give a bit of a background.
Please.
So I think, like, in our communities, people are really close, and there's a big sense of community and support. But I think the ugly side of that is that people are really into each other's businesses and judge each other, and that's maybe that is something that, like, leads to a lot of gossip. And honor is something big, and I think maybe that is a good part of the film. But also, it's the thrill of the different characters, which I think, to me, like, it seems to many people, I think that would seem like it's a fantasy. But I know, because I am from old Cairo, that these characters exist the same way that they were in the film, and all these stuff happen. And I have very similar stories from my neighborhood, Bab al-Sharay. So yeah, that's just to give background.
There you go.
And I think let me say something. If you're listening to this podcast, just stop the podcast, go watch the film, and then come back and continue the podcast. It's called The Allies. Where do you find it? I think it's on Netflix.
It's
I didn't find it on Netflix.
Depending on what part of the world you are,
yeah.
In most places it's on Netflix. In the UK, it's not. In the UK, it's on Channel 4.
Mm.
And then if you fail to find it, there are 2-3 locations where it's not on Netflix.
So on Amazon Prime,
you'll probably find it on Amazon Prime or Apple or one of these stores. So yeah. So now that you've seen it and you're back, the film to me is gossip is a big thing in a conservative society. Gossip is a policing tool, and so living in a claustrophobic, intimate neighborhood like that, you get really two sides of. There's the good, the bad. There's a sort of a brotherly love. There's sort of a care for each other. There's a sort of a greater family energy to the neighborhood. But simultaneously, because everybody lives so close to one another and because it's a conservative society, people tend to put masks on and wear social masks so that they're having to be a bit more performative in their everyday lives because of this social policing that happens through gossip. And for men and women, it happens differently. For men, it's all about machismo and or being a successful business person in this or that. And if you don't quite fit those socially appreciated boxes, let's say, or these boxes where people get a sense of self-worth from, then it becomes really hard, and you have to really start putting on masks and finding different ways to find your social acceptance.
Mm.
And for women, it's a little more obvious in a conservative society. You know, a woman's honor needs to be preserved at all costs, and it has an effect on the family.
Mm.
And so these elements sort of, I took a number of them and wrote them out into a multi-character film. Again, research was a big part of it. So it was going around neighborhoods and listening to the stories that people told. Again, and this is, some of them are true, some of them are exaggerations, some of them are lies, but it gave me what I thought was the spirit of the film, which is this, these stories could be truth, lies, or exaggerations, but they are the spirit of what you hear in the street. And that's what I thought.
The voice of the neighborhood.
The voice of the neighborhood. So that's one side. The other side that played a big factor eventually, because I was trying to be too authentic at the beginning and it became a real burden, was accept that I'm making the film. I didn't grow up in such a neighborhood, but I do have an appreciation for a particular genre of films. And that's where the pulpy dark comedy elements came in. And so it became a mix of these two worlds for me.
Well, I think you did well, and
thank you.
Yeah, it's still, for me, it's a very entertaining film, and it does representation well. So from that, then I know like that you were a part of a big film that was meant to be like one of a kind, coming from a big streaming service.
Yes.
And you were one of the first people that worked on that project. And then you left.
That's one way to put it. So it was a series. It was a big series. It was supposed to be the first of its kind in the region. And I guess what happened there was... let's put aside that there were maybe too many cooks in the kitchen. I think the main problem for me was everything we just talked about as far as research and authenticity and being true to the region and telling stories from our perspective, the way we think feels right when, you know, your barometer for what feels authentic and right in your body tells you that something feels inauthentic and false. And the decision makers involved weren't allowing for it to become what it could have been, which is something, you know, authentic. Well, authentic, it's a Jin story at the end of the day. So let's, maybe authentic isn't the right word, but let's say resonates true to the people from the region.
I think there's that issue that you see also in Hollywood, is that big studios, I don't know what they're doing, but they're doing something where, like you said, too many cooks in the kitchen. And I think, I don't know if they're following numbers or algorithms, but then they end up with something that is a mishmash that like kind of like has no sort of any identity.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that is what happened with you, but I'm not sure.
I mean, part of it is, I think there was a lack of willingness to try and understand the... our world from our perspective and trying to tell something authentic from there. Again, beyond the too many cooks in the kitchen. And then, but I think you touch on something interesting, is I think producers, I think in the West now with the rise of the algorithm have maybe lost, lost the ability to give creative story advice and good story notes and good script notes. I think that's a skill that feels like it's been lost, because, you know, we're watching films sometimes and you're just thinking the story fails on a number of levels, or you see something and you're like, okay, so they filmed an early draft of something that could have been really cool, but they never pushed it to get there, because they had, you know, the algorithm said, if you put this person and that person with this kind of style, then this will work.
If this worked well, so if we recreated but with this character from this country, or, and then we can appeal to this audience.
Exactly.
And,
then,
yeah. And this is a good time for this
audience. This is a good time for instead of just giving good story notes.
It's just instead of just making good films.
Instead of making just good films.
But then you went from that, you left that project, and that was, I think, before you made The Allies, right?
Yes. I'm trying to remember if I had written... Oh, yeah, I had written a couple of drafts of The Allies that I wasn't happy with, and then jumped on board this, and then went back to The Allies.
So you left that, and that was before you made The Allies, and then you made The Allies, which is, like we said, a good film. You just made a good film. And and it ended being very successful and trending on many platforms, and especially Netflix, right?
Yeah, we're quite happy with how the film did on Netflix. It seemed to resonate with people. They seemed to enjoy watching something that had this fun element that was also, the accents were authentic. The story felt like it was, yes, it's dramatized, but it felt like it was something from our world, and not imposed, and not, as other films have done or attempted to do, is from the West just simply impose something that is foreign and just assume that the people of another country and of another ethnicity just behave in the same way, which is not true. So it was something that felt, I think, that people resonated with, and in the same way that you saw a parallel with Cairo, I think a lot of people who grew up in cities just saw in the Arab world saw something similar to their world. I think that's part of the reason.
I think I wrote an article about when I think I did. I'm not too sure. Because I wrote so many articles when I was working as a journalist.
Okay.
But I think I wrote an article that was that was titled "The Price of Arab Films Going International is That Arab Films Are No Longer Arab Films." It was something along that line of that sort of with streaming services and that kind of direction to appeal to a larger audience, you kind of lose what makes an authentic story. So I really appreciate you saying that.
And then, but I also say that part of the problem is the financing, and not just streamers, even in the co-production model, where European co-producers are looking for content where they can co-produce with the Arab world to make films, which is one of the few ways that we can actually finance films in the Arab world. And so these co-production partners, again, have sort of a neo-Oriental view of the Arab world, and have a neo-Oriental a desire to watch a neo-Oriental version of what they think we are. And so we ended up making films that sort of tick boxes for, either the streaming services, which we just talked about, who are much better now, by the way, and then the co-production model, where you do get some good films out of them, but they also end up making the same type of films over and over because they seem to appeal to this neo-Orientalist view of what the Arab world should look like to them on cinema, right? Mm. Rather than being grassroots.
The Allies. Where was the controversy? Because I don't get it.
I don't get it either. But I'll tell you what people were saying. One of the main points was this is inauthentic, and anybody who's been in the Arab world knows that that's false. Let's put aside all the research I did and blah blah blah, and everything everybody knows. But I think there's a desire in the Middle East by some people, let's call them a loud minority, who want to project or present the Arab world as idyllic as they could in their own, through their own lens. And so to them, this was sort of how dare we explore our more.
How do we portray side. Flaws?
Yeah. How do we explore our flaws? That's a perfect way to put it. And
I think something in the Arab world, I think that we don't realize is that that cinema of good representation and neat characters just doesn't exist anymore.
Doesn't exist anywhere. It's called propaganda, and
it's called propaganda. That's what they want us to make.
That's what they want us to make, and I mean, they're free to make it if they want to.
The Western world want us to make what did you call
it? Neo-Orientalist
stuff, and the Arab world want us to make propaganda.
Propaganda, and so
this is the title of the problem. Between Neo-Orientalist and propaganda, where do we go?
And yeah, and now we need to find finance somehow. How we do that? But it's a funny thing. So that's part of where the controversy came from. And then what I understand is, and this is what I find interesting, and I have a bit of sympathy for some of these people who've come out against the film.
Mm.
And think of it this way: it's a conservative society where politically you can't say much.
Yeah.
And so conservative members who have political aspirations, I'm just going to keep it vague like that, don't have a lot of room to engage in dialogue or public debate on something.
Mm.
And the little bit of space they have is in something like the arts.
Mm.
So they see a film and they think, oh, these are a bunch of artists. We can attack them. That's going to be easy. Nobody's going to come and sort of suppress this dialogue.
Yeah.
And so they engaged really hard on this because it allows them to present their perspective, which is these are our ways and these are our...
plug themselves as well.
Yeah, it gives them something to talk about with a little less fear, let's say, of trying to push their very conservative social and religious and cultural agendas. So it ends up being a really loud, small portion, loud minority. And I'll tell you the silver lining in all of this for me is throughout all of this, the majority of the team, except Mundir Rayahni, our great... one of our great lead actors who really put himself forward and fiercely faced all of these people on TV, which I love. That aside...
Who did that?
Mundir Rayahni, who plays the gangster in the film.
Ah.
Well, he has that aura. He can take it on.
Definitely. Like, I will be scared.
He definitely has a presence.
Such a cool guy, yeah.
He is. But the silver lining is that none of us needed to say anything. People came out and defended the film and defended the authenticity of the film and defended the fact that this is something we need to address as a society. Mm. And we need to address these issues in society rather in the film. We don't need to address the fact that there's a film about it, but we need to look at society and these ideas that we explore in the film. And we didn't have to do anything. And the majority of the comments came out and people came out on TV. People we didn't ask to be on TV to just came out and defended the film and defended the authenticity of the film and defended the fact that these are our flaws in society and we need to look at them.
Yeah.
So that was, it was really nice to have sparked that conversation. Mm. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. That's... I think it worked all for the best.
It worked for the best.
Yeah, but it's crazy because it's like the same stuff exactly happens in Egypt, like very, very similarly.
The controversy or the dialogue or which part are you talking about? Or the story of the film?
Everything. No, I mean the way people are like very triggered when you portray some flaws in society. And the same that when people don't engage in the political sphere in general,
right,
that makes them already kind of like piled up, and they and there's like whenever there's an outlet for anything, people go like hard on it because I guess it's like democracy is not practiced in its best and ways. So that's
how it comes out with a lot of anger and really loud.
You then shifted to documentaries and you made Chasing Dreams. How's that shift to documentaries, and maybe tell us more about Chasing Dreams?
Sure.
How did you get about making this story? And
well, we were talking earlier about how I had a bad experience with one of these on one of these projects, and so when I left, and this was before making the Allies, I needed something to, you know, get my head straight. I wasn't in a creatively good place, and so a friend of mine, Hashim Sabbagh, comes to me and he's like, there's this Brazilian team and they're scouting for talented footballers in a Za'atari refugee camp in the north of Jordan, which is a Syrian refugee camp, and you know, whoever they pick is going to fly out to Brazil and start their journey into becoming professional footballers. And so it's like, I'm here. It started out as like, let's just shoot this initial part of the journey. It'll become a short documentary of sorts. And that short, and I needed, I wasn't, again, I'm not a documentary guy, but I thought I would meet the kids first that had been selected and see, you know, if there was potential for story there. Because thinking of story in documentary is totally different. It's not a, you don't write out the story, obviously. But you need to know that there is runway, there's story runway here. And there was plenty of it. And the kids I fell in love with, they're incredible. And so we ended up following these five boys. The youngest was 13 at the time, or 14, and the oldest was 17. And we followed their journey from Za'atari to Brazil. And the majority of the series takes place in Brazil, where they, you know, really hone in their football talents and socially explore a country that is totally different from Syria, totally different from Jordan, totally different from Za'atari refugee camp, and sort of find themselves as professionals and find themselves as people in Brazil. And what started out as what was supposed to be a short documentary ended up being, oh, maybe this is a feature, ended up being, oh, this is a 6-part series. And yeah, because the story runway kept giving, and it was a very, very rewarding journey for me personally.
And it's such a great story.
And because they are who they are, these boys, it makes it even more rewarding that they go through this, and you see someone, you literally see someone change and evolve and mature and fall in love and get their heart broken, both professionally and personally, and it's just such a raw lens and raw view of life that you know, sometimes we're able to capture because we were there in the moment, and other times not so easily. But yeah, so it was very rewarding for me to, again, you know, since we spoke about how difficult writing is, this is a bit refreshing in the sense that you need to anticipate story. You don't know where something is going, you don't know what sort of arc or which arc you're following, because we shot a lot of things that we didn't end up using because the story didn't go there. But you have to anticipate. So it was a nice way of thinking differently, away from the keyboard.
Away from the keyboard.
AFK.
AFK. Love that. So I feel like you, and I know that as well, like authenticity and changing narrative is basically, I would say, the title of your filmmaking. And it's like, it seems to me like it's also your kind of obsession in a good way. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure.
Especially like with the film industry, where it is, and maybe where it was and where it is now, and how is that going?
Well, the industry isn't in a great place right now. It's not in a great place right now. I mean, right now, COVID sort of ensured that the streamers became the major players, and then COVID disappeared, so people were offline again, or not offline, not as like needing of this material. And then with the surge of AI, so you had this inflation of productions, and now deflation, and then now AI is bringing fears into the creative process, and oh, okay, so things are going to cost a fraction of what they used to cost. So I think the industry is just, clearly the industry is frightened, and this is what people are talking about. I don't know what the future of film and cinema and TV is, and TikToks and the YouTubes of the world are sort of cannibalizing that space, which is the attention, people's attention, and people's let's say screen hours. So I don't know what the future of that is, but you know, that aside, going back to the question of authenticity, I don't know. I don't know if it's a choice for me. Some people, you know, maybe they can switch that off. But for me, there's an integrity in, again, depending on the story, this doesn't apply to all stories, but there's an integrity in trying to make something, when you're trying to make something, to make sure that you did your best, because there's no way a film can be totally representative of anything. And at the end of the day, it's a film, you know, there's entertainment value there for me. Some people don't see the need for that, but that aside, for me, I think there's an entertainment value. There's an integrity in trying to be authentic, but there's only so much you can do to make sure that it is still entertaining.
And how is that in terms of like you working outside of the Arab world and working in to Western audiences? And
right.
How do you navigate that as an Arab director, filmmaker, writer?
Still finding it. Exactly. I did some boxing earlier in life, and I've developed a boxing film alongside a friend of mine, a person who I met through the film, Jasmir Gill, who's become a close friend and a collaborator. We wrote a film called Hall Fighter that we're trying to get.
Next thing, right?
That's one of the next things. The next thing that I feel like, and nobody hold me prisoner to this, the next thing I think that's going to move for me, hopefully, I'm very hopeful that this can be around this time next year, is a Palestinian dark comedy that I'm doing, set pre-genocide in Jerusalem, about a family in Silwan, which is a neighborhood in Jerusalem, and it's developing it with the British Film Institute here, and calling it Occupational Hazards. So, and it's about the creative ways that Palestinians find to navigate apartheid and occupation and life there in the most creative and ingenious ways that are at times, you know, darkly hilarious. And so, again, based on research, I heard a few stories and I was like, this is so genius, it has to be explored in a film. And that was the impetus of what is hopefully going to become a film called Occupational Hazards.
Okay, so again, I think, so how are you making these films and how are they being received then? In the world that we live in right now with all its politics, with everything that is going on?
It's been interesting. So far, Occupational Hazards, from the people I've approached, has been received quite well. But you need to know who to approach. I have had some funny reactions from some people.
Unsurprisingly.
So I did have some funny reactions, unsurprisingly, from some, let's say, potential funding partners that I thought were, let's say, on the right side of history. I'm being quite selective with who I approach with this one. And so far, we've had some good response. Myself and Charlotte Knowles, the producer, and Rula Nasser, our other producer. It's been a good development journey, let's say. Development, I think part of your question is how is the West different from
as well.
Shooting in the Middle East?
I'll tell you what I'm thinking.
Tell me.
I'm thinking, I ask myself, when is it that, someone like you, like
What is someone like me?
A great filmmaker.
Okay.
is gonna be like, you know, Christopher Nolan or Tarantino, all these American, like the American hegemony. When is that American hegemony is gonna open up to Arabs specifically? Because, like, you know, I think there's also a level of like kind of openness that we still, as Arabs, I guess, bit still excluded of it.
Yeah. I mean, Denis Villeneuve is one of the directors I really love.
Mm.
I will say, though, on Dune, since the film was based on the book and since the book was so inspired by the Middle East and the Arab world and Bedouin culture and Arab culture, and
there's not a single Arab person in the
there's
film.
Not a single Arab person in the film.
I stopped watching his films.
I stopped watching that film. Well, it was they were his last two films.
But I think I find a hint of kind of slight kind of racism in
there absolutely is, and so I, you know, I also have friends who worked on those films, and understandably so, because Denis Villeneuve is a great director and amazing creator. On this, I just can't understand why, given that the films were so inspired by the Arab world,
they're speaking Arabic
or some, you know, some derivation of it.
Badly. Like Sheikh Khulud.
I'm not going to comment on that, but yes.
Yeah.
And filmed in Wadi Rum, where we filmed Dieb, and they film a lot of the Martian films.
Yeah.
And not even an attempt to have an Arabic actor in there. Somewhere. Not even somewhere. I mean, the extras were, because obviously they shot where.
Yeah,
but
it's like this, like orcs in the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. It's like, thanks for that breadcrumbs. So that's my two cents on that. It bothers me, and clearly bothers you. I didn't know that. Yeah.
No, it definitely does. Do you think that future is probably coming? Because we now like kind of see some. There's some, like, people carving their way out. You're one of them.
Trying to. I think there needs to be systematic change, making, you know, I think there's plenty of folks like me who are trying to break through with one film at a time here and there, and it's already painfully draining just making a film, developing it, and making it, and financing it, and then putting it together and all of that. But I think for something to change drastically, there needs to be something systematic, or you need something that really proves, because, you know, people are financially driven, or these institutions are financially driven, so you need some sort of breakout that just says, you know, the Arab world can be the next Korea, for example. I don't know how feasible that is, but that is one way it can happen. The other way is, you know, we were talking about a second ago how the system as it is might collapse. Maybe that's not such a bad thing for us.
Mm.
Who's to say that these big studios, why are they good? I mean, what's to say that maybe the system, once broken, can't rebuild itself in a more interesting way, where it's much more decentralized, where stories can be told in from a variety of perspectives, and we aren't falling into the issues that we were just talking about over and over and over again, and folks from the Arab world could actually get a chance.
Well, Bessel, it has been an absolute pleasure. I really, really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, man, thank you for having me. This was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for coming, and I cannot wait to watch the next.